WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In the thriller Misery, Kathy Bates plays Annie Wilkes, a registered nurse and an obsessive fan of romance novelist Paul Sheldon, played by James Caan. It's the first major movie role for Bates. Her previous work has been on the stage in such plays as Night Mother, Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, and Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean. Misery opens as Paul Sheldon finishes a new novel in the quiet of a remote Colorado cabin. On the drive home, he gets caught in a blizzard and drives off the road. The unconscious rider is rescued by the nurse, played by Bates, who turns out to be his number one fan. Too bad she's also crazy. She nurses him back to health, and she creates makeshift casts for his two broken legs, but she keeps him as her prisoner. And as he begins to heal, she makes sure he stays disabled. This is a clip from the most revolting scene in the movie, the sledgehammer scene. Even if you haven't seen the film, you'll remember this from the TV ads. But the ad ends before we actually see how Annie hurts Paul.
I know you've been out twice, Paul. First, I couldn't figure out how you did it. But last night, I found your key. I know I left my scrapbook out. I can imagine what you might be thinking of me. But you see, Paul, it's all okay. Last night, it came so clear. I realize you just need more time. Eventually, you'll come to accept the idea of being here. Paul, do you know about the early days at the Kimberly Diamond Mines? Do you know what they did to the native workers who stole diamonds? Don't worry, they didn't kill them. That would be like junking a Mercedes just because it had a broken spring. No, if they caught them, they had to make sure they could go on working, but they also had to make sure they could never run away. The operation was called hobbling.
Annie, whatever you're thinking about doing, please don't do it. Annie, for God's...
Shh, darling. Trust me.
Do you want to explain what you do in this scene?
Technically, I put a board between his legs and I break his ankles.
You know, it's such a... This is the scene that you walk away thinking, oh gosh, I hope I don't think about this scene very often. It really hurts to watch it.
Yeah, my sister, who's had a problem with her ankle, said it was particularly difficult for her.
What did you actually hit?
I actually hit a prosthetic leg that was built for us by the special effects team, KNB. And they built a couple of really very realistic legs that we used in that particular shot.
Did this image haunt you?
No, it was more of a technical problem for me, Terry, and I think it was more of a difficult shot in terms of camera angles, and so by the time we'd gone through it several times, that was what I was more interested in, was trying to get it right than anything else.
What was your reaction when the first time you saw it on screen?
I thought it looked great. I couldn't believe it worked so well.
Have people been telling you that this film relates to... Have well-known people been telling you that this film relates to phobias they have about their own fans?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. Rob Reiner told me that Ringo Starr had come to one of the early screenings and liked the film very much, and afterwards went outside and was walking, I guess, to the car with friends, and some woman came up to him on the street who completely out of the blue and said, "Oh, are you Ringo Starr?" And he said, "Yes." She said, "I'm your number one fan." And he just turned white, apparently. I think that was the wrong time for him to hear that.
Well, everybody's probably been coming up to you and saying they're your number one fan.
Yes, they are. I was on The Tonight Show last night, and I said it to Barry Manilow just to be mean.
And I understand that you studied tapes of psychopathic killers before doing the role.
Yes.
What did you look
actually
at?
I read some books, and I did see some tapes of nurses who kill.
Where did you find the tape?
Well, quite by accident. Right after I was cast in the role, I saw a program on Geraldo Rivera, and they had a program on nurses who kill. I thought there was only one or two, but there were quite a few out there, apparently. And
it's like a theme show made for you.
Yeah, and these were male nurses, actually. The chilling thing about these portraits was that the individuals who were in prison for committing these crimes were extremely disconnected to the event itself. And one of them, I remember saying, well, I know I must have done it because I'm in jail. But he had no connection to what he had done at all. And I liked that disconnection. And going back to your first question, I think emotionally that's what's happening with Annie during the hobbling. There's just absolutely no real connection to the event and the pain that she's causing this other human being. And I think that's a central characteristic of a psychopath, a sociopath.
This was really your first big movie role. How are you cast in the role?
I was handed it by Mr. Rob Reiner. He had seen my work out in L.A. as a stage actor, and he called and said that he was interested in hiring me to do the lead in his new film. And I was thrilled when I heard it was going to be Misery, because it was a book that I had read some years ago, and I'd always secretly wanted to play the character of Annie.
Do you think that not being glamorous and being what would be considered slightly overweight by conventional standards has stood in your way in terms of your movie career?
I'm sure it's kept me from getting roles that, you know, I might have wanted to get, and because people don't look at women, I think, in a, let me rephrase that. I think definitely Hollywood and Madison Avenue have pigeonholed women's physical traits into a certain narrow area, which lets a lot of us out of the a lot of us out of the room there, and that's something that's always bothered me. It's not something that I've always wanted to bend my my shape to fit their desires. I'm hoping that things will change, that people will start casting people because they're good actors. Maybe I'm being really naive, even at the age of 42, but I keep hoping that it'll change.
Well, it's funny, even, you know, one of the roles that you played on stage in Night Mother went to, you know, a beautiful, very slender actress, Sissy Spacek, in the movie.
Yes. Well, the role originally was written for an anorexic 45-year-old. And then I played the role, and it's interesting. I remember there was a theater in Texas that was advertising for casting for the role, and advertised it should be 30s and overweight. So, I mean, you know, go figure. I don't know why. You know, I often get asked this question, especially by male interviewers, you know, about my weight and about rejection and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's so interesting that I probably wouldn't be discussing this if I wasn't a woman. I'm not sure exactly why that has to be, but it certainly is reality for me.
Well, I'll tell you, though, it's been my observation that most of the character roles and people who don't have the conventional looks, male or female, usually end up as character actors in movies. I mean, that's just the reality of it. But most of the really good character roles are male roles, and I find that there's very few really good character roles for women. And it seems that most of the women who really make it in movies are the ones who look right, you know, who have the fashion model kind of looks.
Right. That's true. I wish that there were, my heroes, I mean, people always ask me, you know, who were your favorite, you know, actors when you were growing up? It was those male character actors like Lee J. Cobb, you know, and Spencer Tracy, and people who had some weight to them, people who not just physically, but they had a center, they were plugged in. You know, that was the kind of image that I was interested in, and I would like for that to change for women in film and in television. I mean, I don't think women have to go around, you know, everybody, whenever you start talking like this, men always say, oh, okay, everybody has to look like a slob. That's not what I mean. I just, you know, I think there just needs to be more open-mindedness and appreciate women for who they are instead of what they're trying to become.
Well, I think women who go to movies feel that way, too, because I always feel like I can never find myself on screen, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's
I can't relate to these fashion model looks.
I remember going to see a movie, I guess it was Tom Cruise's movie, Cocktail. I was sitting next to two teenage girls, and the minute the ingenue came on screen, she hadn't been on screen a half a second when they said, she's fat. Now, here was this girl who was not fat. You know, I mean, it was really scary. I was thinking, my God, what is this, you know, perception going on here? And it, here it has started there at, what, 13, 14 years old. You know, how is their judgment going to affect their lives personally? Right now, they're projecting it onto somebody else on screen. But how is that projection going to affect their psyche and their physical nature?
How did you start your stage career?
I started doing some plays in high school, and then I studied acting in at college, and then I went to New York in 1970 and tried it with everybody else, and began to do work off Broadway there, and then off Broadway, and finally Broadway, and did some regional theater around the country. It's difficult to get started in the business nowadays because fewer plays are being done in New York, and it's hard for kids to come to New York and find a way to showcase their talents without having to be in the unions. And so it's a difficult business now. It was a little easier back when I started.
I have one bone to pick with the, this isn't with the acting, but with the characterization of the woman that you play. I don't think she'd be listening to Liberace records in her room. I think she'd probably be listening to Elvis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I think Liberace is better because of her disconnectedness to her sexual libido, you know. And I think Elvis, the pelvis, definitely is, I think, a little bit too raunchy for her. I think Liberace's a little more feet-off-the-ground kind of music for her. And I kind of agree with Mr. King on that, so I have to disagree with you, Terry.
But I see you've really thought it through.
Yeah.
Kathy Bates, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me. It was a pleasure.